Our podcast guest, Mark Chi, would like us to say the following with regards to the podcast. Dear listeners, I wish to state that the views and opinions that I expressed in this podcast are personal and do not represent those of the University of Tennessee. I also wish to correct a mistake that I made during the interview. Germany was a central power during the First World War, not an Axis power. The central powers of 1914 to 1918 were composed of Germany, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, and Bulgaria. Lastly, although I make comparisons between influenza virus and coronavirus, please note that the two are not related. Although they are respiratory, the diseases that they cause are not the same. Thank you for listening.
We want to thank everybody for listening today. This is our Back in the Day podcast with the Metro Archives. I'm Ken Feith, and we have Sarah Arntz, one of the archivists, here today. We have a very special guest with us, Dr. Mark Chi. He's done some very interesting work in vaccinations and microbiology and things like that. And I'll let Dr. Chi introduce himself, and then we'll have some questions for him and just sit back and enjoy.
Thank you very much, Ken. I'm Mark Chi. I'm an assistant professor of biology at the University of Tennessee Southern. We're in Pulaski in Giles County. I joined the school in 2015 when it was still Martin Methodist College.
Okay. I wondered about that when we saw UT, University of Southern. All right, that explains that.
We'll start with which would you prefer to talk about first, the research you did on the Spanish influenza or the film festival you're currently doing?
I guess we can marry the two.
Okay.
I can start with the Spanish flu.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like a good start.
Yeah. So I was originally hired by Martin Methodist College to teach microbiology to nursing students. So that's when I really had this kind of shift away from what I was trained as in my PhD years. And so my PhD years, my focus was on very basic biology questions. It's basically cell division. How does one cell become two? And so the medical focus of my research was at best related to cancer. But since coming to Martin, because of the nature of the student population that I was teaching, my interest started to gravitate more towards infectious diseases. And interestingly, right before I came to Martin, I was actually working on something that one of my students picked up, which was that we were actually working with fruit flies. But one day, my student noticed that the flies were actually dying, and they were dying of something that we determined was transmissible. So it was contagious, and it killed the majority of the flies in a very heinous way, in that the flies would completely blacken at the time when they're about to form pupae. So that was one of the things that kind of started me on this infectious diseases journey. So from there, in 2015, I guess we were in the midst of the 100th anniversary celebrations of World War I, which started in 1914. And in 2018, I reached out to Professor Michael Birdwell at Tennessee Tech. I believe it was the Tennessee Great War Commission that he was a part of. And I just, you know, threw out an idea, which is like, are you looking for somebody who could talk about the influenza of 1918? Because this is one of the things I talk about in my class. And turns out Birdie was very kind. He wrote back and he knew that I wasn't a historian, but, you know, he said, that's exactly the thing we're missing from the symposium that I'm organizing this year. So all aboard. In November, I went to Cookeville to give my talk, and I think it went really, really well. I think something that a lot of my students probably wouldn't know unless I've talked about it with them is that history is always a passion of mine as a student. I went the biology route because after I talked to one of my history professors in school, and what he told me, you know, I was wondering aloud with him, you know, which should I do? I really like history. I really like science. And then he was like, you know, it happens a lot in life. Like one of the things that you choose as your profession and the other is you keep it as your pastime. Mm-hmm. So I went with biology as my
perfect advice.
Yeah. So biology was it, but I've always had my eye on history, and the Great War is always a passion. After I, in school, interestingly, it wasn't an event that impacted where I grew up personally. I grew up in Singapore, which is a British colony. So our experience of the Great War was very distant. We knew that the Empire was engaged in this battle with Germany, but it wasn't anything that affected the Asian colonies of the Empire because Germany couldn't really threaten us. And the only direct experience we had was this visit by a German warship during that time. But I think it was still a time that a lot of Singaporeans of the educated class felt that there was this duty to the Empire. So they did things like they would buy munitions and donated fighter aircraft to the Royal Flying Corps at the time. But there wasn't that direct connection. The direct connection for us really only comes in World War II. So, but, you know, I've always felt that World War II is the more exciting sequel, but there was so much in World War I that people kind of forgot. And not understanding that really gives us a very shallow understanding of World War II. And of course, you know, fast forward all these years, when now being a biologist, I also realized that the influenza, which comes about in the final year of the Great War, has this disproportionate impact. And, you know, a lot of people seem to have conveniently forgotten that as well, that it killed like, 20 to 50 million people is what we estimate. And how is it that, you know, a death of this magnitude, right, a pandemic of this magnitude that we now know may have infected one-third of the world population seems to have just disappeared from the public memory.
You know, I'm glad you're talking about that because, you know, it came on the tail end of World War One, and so everyone's all excited about the end of the war, but that didn't really end a lot. There's a lot of things that didn't end, but that all the tight-knit people together, you know, and that virus got started. So I'm glad you're talking about that because it, you know, it probably killed as many people as World War II. I don't know, but, you know, it was significant.
On the low end of the estimates, we're thinking it killed twice as many people as all the combatants who died in World War I. And it's fascinating to think about because the Great War is the first time where we see, I think the saying is that we industrialized warfare, right? So we have like massive improvements in firepower, which are not matched by improvements in either medical care or mobility in terms of the troops. So you have this literal meat grinder, and we got so good at murder, and yet... You know, the one of the things I did in my talk in 2018 was I had a little animation that where I start talking about all the military improvements, and then this little it's a plush toy version of the of the Spanish flu, and it scoots across the screen, and that's the thing that everybody pays attention to because it's like, you know, this little guy is going to come around and he's going to kill more people than we could even imagine of all this stuff going on that you read about in Wilfred Owen's poems. It's amazing. And I guess the other thing that kind of motivated me to reach out to Birdie was that the fact that a lot of my students were not aware that America had participated in the Great War. So it's a conveniently forgotten fact that this is the war that turned America from a territorial military power or regional military power into an international one. Because you're coming in at the end of the war when the Europeans have already bled themselves white, right? 3 years later, and America is going to feel this massive army far larger than anything she has in the past. And the scale of that preparation is what provides these fertile conditions for the flu to begin. So, the best evidence that we have is that the influenza of 1918 begins in America, and where there's a transmission event between waterfowl to humans somehow.
Really?
Yeah, and the clues that we have point to one of these 33 dozen or so army camps that have been set up very hastily. You know, you look at the U.S. military now, and like it's so much money and manpower and material. Back then, my colleague in history called it basically the beggar's army, right? Because you were asked to field a force that's a million strong. You're going from 100,000 strong, roughly, where the most prominent conflict fought to date was the Spanish-American War, to now fielding a million-man army that's capable of taking the best that Europe has to throw at you. And you have very little time to do it because America declares war April 1917, and you have all this pressure from the French and the British to, like, throw your men onto the battlefield now. And fortunately, America appoints General Pershing, and Pershing's condition is, my men will hit the battlefield when I think they're ready. And it takes a long time to train those men.
That was popular.
But kudos to him, because when they finally show up, I think it's September 1917 when they finally show up, and in large enough numbers that Pershing is confident that, all right, the men are ready to fight. And they do splendidly in the first battle that they participate in. But to get to that point, you know, this really long training period, and these 3 dozen or so camps have been set up very hastily around the country, each one holding about 25,000 to 50,000 men.
Wow.
And they're hastily erected with plywood sometimes, right? You have very crowded bunks. Mm-hmm. And it so happens that in one of these detachments, apparently in Kansas, that's where the first instances or the first outbreak of an unusual flu begins. Hmm. And this is pre-CDC days. We only had a very nascent United States Public Health Service at the time, and they were not capable of doing even the things that the CDC does today. CDC today is very hamstrung, but it does have a kind of a national level view of what's happening when there's a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But you require the reporting, the cooperation of all the states and territories. Back then, it was basically all the responses were local. So even though one of the reports I read was that a local doctor had noticed that there were some very serious instances of flu coming up in Kansas near Camp Riley, I believe it was, the local people, the local public health authority basically just said, and it'll be fine, right? Right. And so it gets into the camp, and that's fertile grounds for it to now spread. And then, you know, you have a lot of men now reporting sick. But because of the demands of the war, there's to be no slowing down in the preparation of the American Expeditionary Force. So some of these men, they're getting onto the ships headed for Europe. Some of them appear healthy, but by the time they arrive, they're deadly sick. They're really ill. And that first contact, when you think about it, this is one of the things that really fascinates me about the Spanish influenza, unfortunately named. But when it all throughout, all you see, what makes it such a deadly pandemic, in my opinion, is that you've got fertile conditions everywhere for disease transmission. Right? You're just putting people close together all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're on these troop ships where, if you see those photographs, you got people hanging off the sides, right? And if all it takes is one guy to be sick within 3 to 5 days, the incubation period for that flu is 3 to 5 days, right? But the passage between Boston and London was about 2 to 3 weeks, if I remember, by troop ship.
Oh, man.
And sometimes you couldn't sail on a straight line because of the U-boats. So fertile breeding grounds. And then once they get there, they're going on to the trenches, right? They're getting in contact with very crowded European cities. That's just basically asking for trouble. Like the virus has a perfect playground to spread.
We sort of took it to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the way this thing spreads, the entire ship could be infected and they not know it by the time
they get
there.
And then once you get there, again, you're being bivouacked or billeted in, like, really close, crowded conditions. And then when you think about it, eventually, now when you move it, you're infecting the British, you're infecting the French, because the American troops are moving up to the front. And then those troops are going to come in contact with the Germans. And then now it spreads onto the other side, right? And one of the unknowns, the great unknowns, we have really good documentation of how the flu spread in the Western Europe, European countries. What we don't have a very good idea of is how bad it was for the Axis powers and beyond.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things that we you know, the reason why it's called Spanish flu, and I think some people notice, is that it's because Spain was a neutral power during World War One, so you could freely report about it in Spain. But The Allies and the Axis both quashed any news about the flu because they didn't want the other side to know how bad it was. So that name stuck. And
I was wondering.
Yeah.
Poor Spanish.
I mean, yeah, I know. They're like, hold on a minute.
Stuck with it for 100 years.
Yeah. So I recently read, this is really funny, funny to me in this context, in our day and age, but the Spanish were so angry about it that they started to say, no, this is something that blew over from France. All right, so you got to blame them instead.
Figure it out. Blame the French.
Don't blame us. We didn't start this mess.
That's right. And the funny thing is that this is also, when you think about it, we really have to kind of like move ourselves back in time, right? So at the beginning of the 20th century, we still have doctors who believe that infectious diseases spread through so-called miasmas, right? Something wafting in through the window that makes you sick. And so the traditional treatment for in their time, up to the end of the 19th century, is that if you're sick of something, we think it's infectious, then we're going to send you off somewhere for fresh air.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Definitely seen a lot of ads for that. Or giving you something to clear out your digestive system was a very popular one as well.
Right. Yeah. And so the idea that, you know, infectious diseases are caused by microorganisms comes about only with, ironically, it's a German doctor, Paul Koch. And, of course, with a lot of influence from Louis Pasteur as well, who's made a lot of discoveries about microbes by this time. But that really doesn't take off until after World War One. In World War One, I mean, we still don't have a lot of good remedies for anything infectious. We've got maybe the first two vaccines to be widely distributed, smallpox and typhoid, but we don't have antibiotics. Basically, you know, a lot of the stories I've read, it's like, you know, if you got the flu, what was the only treatment they had? It's like basically blankets, chest rubs, and a nurse holding your hand through the night, right, saying a prayer for you. Not to discount any of that, I mean, but, you know, it was a very different time that, that people often have very difficult time kind of imagining. Yeah.
Yep.
So we didn't, we had a vaccination for typhus and for, what was the other one, smallpox?
Smallpox.
Smallpox.
Yes.
So we didn't take a united approach at this. We would find one thing and solve that and find one and solve that. So it's a bit part of the problem as far as influenza?
Yeah, I think the other problem was that there was really no idea no conception of what a virus was at the time. Viruses had been discovered tail end of the 19th century by Beierink in Holland, but what he had discovered was a virus that affects tobacco plants. So the influenza virus is not going to be discovered per se until the 1930s. So so that handicap that we have, not knowing really how infectious diseases work and then not knowing what viruses do or that they even exist, right? In human disease, at least, I think those are huge impairments. And kind of the piecemeal approach to treating infectious diseases that Ken mentioned, I think that was a limitation of how we could actually conceptualize and imagine how these things are transmitted, how they actually cause disease. You know, Paul Koch, whom I just mentioned, he discovered the causes of cholera, anthrax, and tuberculosis. He determined that they're all bacteria. So the people, when the doctors who were first trying to understand 1918 flu, they thought it was bacterial too, because they were so heavily influenced by what Koch had done, plus not really knowing how viruses work, but having microscopes that could allow us to see bacteria, right? And so they were thinking it was something bacterial, and that's where Haemophilus influenzae, that's a bacterium that they were blaming for the 1918 flu, they thought that was it. So they were working really hard to come up with a vaccine against it. And there's at least one report I've read from Manchester, England, where they field tested the Haemophilus influenza vaccine, and it didn't do anything against the 1918 flu. Interestingly, although Haemophilus influenzae is a serious problem for very young children. So that's one of the vaccines that they get today, the HIP vaccine, if you've ever heard of it. Yeah. So, but yeah, I think it was really, you know, you contrast that with like COVID-19, right, where we quickly figured out what kind of virus it was. back then it was really just there's something in the ether literally that's killing us. And almost, I guess it's funny because a lot of people didn't take it seriously at that time. They didn't take it seriously until the second wave came around. The first wave of 1918 was relatively mild, and most people thought it was, well, it's just another seasonal flu. But I think that was basically just setting the stage for the second wave, because when the second wave hits in October of 1918, that's the one where you see a lot of people in their 20s to 40s, right, dropping dead from the flu. And it just turns everything that you think you know about immunology and human health and medicine on its head, because the healthiest people are the ones who are getting sick. The healthiest people are the ones who are dying in really large numbers. And it's so bad that you have some towns that come out of the second wave with only old people and children left.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. Everyone else is dead. Yeah.
Do you bring this up in your, like, the film, or when you do the, you talk about the film?
Yeah. So from there, if we fast forward, like, you know, 4 years to 2022, so from 2018, 2022, in between, what I've been doing is what really gets me interested in using film as kind of a springboard for talking about a lot of these topics is that when I got to Martin, I started using the film Contagion. Right, so that was a 2011 film. I first started using it when I taught at Bard College in 2014. So Bard runs something called Citizen Science, where the plan was to make the first-year students attain a certain level of scientific literacy. And in the words of the Bard president, President Botstein, he just felt that this is a key thing that people were lacking, right, how science actually works. And I took one of the lessons I took from Bard was that Contagion is a film that can engage at multiple levels. And it's because it's the first time where Hollywood sat some people down who actually knew what they were talking about and said, how can we make something that's more grounded, right? A film that's more grounded. And this is hot on the heels of two very serious epidemics that a lot of people may not have heard of in North America. SARS in 2003, whose impact in North America was limited mostly to Canada, and the Nipah virus outbreak, I think somewhere in the second decade. And what the filmmakers did was that they took the worst elements of these two diseases and they said, well, can we make something that's plausible out of this and turn it into a thriller that seems like, you know, something of the same scale as, something of the same kind of impact as SARS in 2003, but scale it up to the point where you get something that approximates 1918. And they did. I mean, back then, I think a lot of us was skeptical. A lot of us who were biology trained or medicine trained, we looked at the film and we thought, yeah, it's pretty good, but we still have all these problems. But most recently, when I rewatched the film with some virologists who work in very high-level containment labs, and they were looking at it and they were saying, like, you know, 10 years down the road and after having lived through COVID-19, like, really have no problem with the film anymore. I mean, we can nitpick it all day, but in terms of showing how people would react during a pandemic, no problem with that. Like, everyone thought the film worked really well in retrospect. So anyway, the idea was, you know, because I can use film to, like, draw students in, right? You use a scenario that humanizes certain things, right? And it's more than just picking information off a textbook or doing a lecture when I'm talking at you, literally, for some of these students. Whereas to see it in action, I think, kind of engages them at a different level. And then what I thought was that in 2022, I got the idea after taking a science communications course with the American Society for Microbio. I was thinking, you know, why don't I try this out on a bigger scale, which is, you know, let's have a full-on film festival. We'll have several topics that are related to infectious diseases. We'll earmark a film for each one of these topics, and then I'll invite people who are interested to talk about this, because what was the other motivating factor was that during COVID-19, I saw this kind of distrust of scientists of medicine, of public health authorities start to build. And I thought that was really, really unnecessary because, you know, we've advanced 100 years since 1918, right? And yet a lot of the attitudes haven't changed. But you saw a lot of the same things happen in 1918. There was a resistance to wearing masks. There was people who were like, nah, it's just the flu.
You know, a lot of denial.
Right. The denial. And then the also there were the folk remedies that came up, right? People who were desperate for a quick fix. And often what you found was that the quick fix was a stiff drink compared...
Hot toddies.
Yeah. Combined with your favorite pill of choice, right? And back then, something that came up was quinine. And quinine was known to have... It only worked against malaria. And the funny part is that that's the forerunner of hydroxychloroquine, which comes up during COVID-19. So it's like,
how about that?
People are coming back to this, right? Because they're desperate. And, you know, that's really what I want to do. I want to create this forum where the students could learn, but at the same time, they would have a chance to interact with these people, which... Some people are saying are beyond us, right? So they're like, they're not to be trusted because they're too dang smart.
And, the irony.
Right. Really? And it's, I think a lot of my students came out of that with eyes open because, you know, you have somebody who's talking to you about viruses, how viruses work, and there are people who've dedicated 20, 30 years of their life to this. Of course they've learned something. And I think it's a great thing that the internet has democratized information the way it has. But we also have to realize that when we're looking at, you know, some of these studies that are conducted in these labs, that we don't always have the full picture as to how to interpret the data that's coming out. And when you actually engage with them, then my students come up with them, they're, you know, I'm asking like, well, you feel like you could debate one of them off the street. And I'm like, you know, probably have to think twice or like do your homework before you try that. And the thing is, at the same time, I think it's very useful to help some of these scientists come out of their like shell, their ivory tower, because they may think, some of them in my day as a PhD student, I've had professors who thought, nah, the public's not ready to hear any of this. But the thing is that, yeah, that may be true, but you guys also have to be prepared to break it down because it's not enough for you to save or to hoard all this knowledge for yourself. You know, when it comes down to it, when we have a global emergency, that's when we see this urgent need, but I think it should be extended all the time to the science that you guys are doing. You're doing really cool science. So take a moment and think about how I would explain this to maybe my child, you know, and not just dismiss everyone and say, like, this is out of their reach, because I think you owe it to them as well. Like, at the end of the day, I think we have to remember that as academics, one of our missions is education. And, you know, we owe it to the public to, like, lift them up as well. And that, I think, will be part of the answer to, like, breaking down this trust barrier where you have certain segments of the population who think they're too smart, they're not to be distrusted, not to be trusted. And then you have certain segments of the science community or the medical community who think, like, yeah, this is too hard for them, right? Yeah, you'll just have to take our word for it. So
finding the middle ground.
I think there's an important middle ground. And I think from the feedback that I got, at least, I think the scientists I invited all had a really good time. And I also tried to make it diverse. So it's not just some research scientists. We had doctors, we had public health professionals, we even had a science writer, and historians. So it's like people who can give you different perspectives, but always with this kind of view, kind of like, hey, let's help you guys lift up. Because especially since my students are mostly, they're training to be health professionals, they're training to be nurses, they're training to be public health professionals, public health educators. We can't have, in my opinion, we can't have nurses who are so influential on their patients, right? Nurses are amongst the most trusted professions in the world. But if they don't have the full picture and they're going to their patient, you're saying, like, try this snake oil, you know, make you feel better. But, you know, yeah, they're well-intentioned, well-meaning, but mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it doesn't help.
Yeah. Yeah. What sort of movies beyond Contagion have you been showing in the film festival?
Okay. So mostly what I ended up using, a lot of them were documentaries. But I've also had a couple of dramatic features, so I tried using a couple of short films. One of the short films I really like using as a teaching tool is about this Hungarian doctor called Ignaz Semmelweis. Mm-hmm. So he was around in the mid-19th century, and he was one of the first proponents of hand washing in medical settings.
Wow.
So there is a really neat short film that was made by somebody at New York University in NYU School of the Arts. And it is a dramatized retelling of the Semmelweis story. What you find is that in the English language tellings of his story, there's a lot of romanticism attached. So, like, he's portrayed as somebody who's really heroic, who's trying to, like, do his best for his patients. There is some truth to that. He was very concerned by something called childbed fever, which affected women who are lying in. And this was such a big problem because women in Austria would avoid going to the hospital because they felt that Vienna General, which was the one of the leading institutions in Europe at the time, medical institutions, your chances of coming out after delivering a child there were not very good.
Oh, dear.
About one in five women would die in childbirth, and they would die of childbed fever. And about slightly smaller fraction of the newborns would die of the same affliction. And the funny thing was that, this is always a shocking story, but the leading medical minds of the time thought that this was just inevitable. It was the lot of being a woman because they didn't understand that this is an infectious disease, right? Hmm. And Semmelweis made a connection. It's ironic because he's Hungarian, and this is one of the things that we need to understand, like walking ourselves back in time. In Austro-Hungary, Hungarians have a lower status than the Austrians. And then he's also in this quandary because he's actually, even though he's Hungarian by nationality, he's German. So he's not, he's German by ethnicity. So he's not considered Hungarian enough by his compatriots on the other side. So he's trying to makes this connection because he notices that childbed fever rates are very high in the ward that's tended by doctors, but it's much lower in the ward that's attended by midwives at Vienna General. And so he's thinking about, you know, what's the difference, right? Midwives versus doctors. And the status of a midwife is not very high at the time, right? It's because women's health is not a priority. Women are not as intelligent as men. You know, as ridiculous as that sounds in our day and age, that was accepted. And the primary kind of the aspiration of the doctors, ironically, is that everybody wants to do autopsies. Everybody wants to figure out why people have died rather than try and take care of the living.
Oh, dear.
Right? So Semmelweis makes the connection when he realizes that the doctors are doing autopsies in between deliveries. And one of his friends cuts himself in the operating theater with a scalpel that's just been used to cut a cadaver. And he dies of what Semmelweis believes is childbed fever. And so after that, he does something very drastic, which is that he says, all the doctors who are training under me, all the medical students training under me, can only see the women in the maternity ward after you wash your hands in liquid chlorine.
Liquid chlorine.
Which sounds very extreme, but
yes,
that's because you don't have running water, right? And soap is not what it is today. It's very alkaline and caustic soap. But he's also thinking, because of miasmas, because they think that putrid odors cause disease, then I've got to use something that removes that odor completely. And thankfully, because... or maybe not, but liquid chlorine is too expensive. So he switches to bleach, sodium hypochlorite. But we know today that that's really nasty to microbes, right? You'll kill all the microbes. So it's very extreme. But after he does that, for 2 years running, he realizes that the childbed fever incidence has gone all the way down. The first year is a little bit rough if you look at his actual data, but by the second year, things are looking much better. But unfortunately, because what he did was considered a breach of protocol, it wasn't approved by the higher-ups, he eventually loses his appointment at the hospital.
Wow.
And,
solve the problem, you get fired.
Yeah. So, and unfortunately, his findings are kind of rejected as nonsense at the time, mostly. There is some kind of corroborative evidence, but a lot of people felt that Semmelweis hadn't done the right experiment. And they're right. Like, a lot of his data, if you look early on, is pretty noisy. But thankfully, you know, some people buy into the idea. And so when you start moving forward to, like, Florence Nightingale and her attempts to improve sanitation in hospitals, she, even though she doesn't really understand how the hand washing works, she buys into it. And she says, like, everybody has to start washing your hands. You have to start keeping the hospital clean. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't do that, then people are just going to die unnecessarily. And, you know, eventually that, as you start going towards the end of the 19th century, then you start having things like Lister coming along and, like, looking into disinfectants, antiseptics, and things start to improve by the time you get to World War I. At least when they do surgeries in World War I, it's with disinfectant in the operating theater. It's no longer the kind of, here's your shot of brandy, and I'm going to saw off your limb. So that's one example. I think the other really cool film that, even though it's a documentary, I thought it was really compelling. As a result of the film festival, I actually collaborated with a group called the Antimicrobial Resistance Fighters Coalition. So the name is really long. But it's a group of concerned scientists and doctors who are looking at the problem that some you guys are probably aware of, antibiotic resistance. Mm. Right. So antibiotics are something that were discovered in 1928 with penicillin. Mm. And then going to the 1930s, that we start to see penicillin production ramp up for World War II. Because that's something that the Allies are going to bring. They want the soldiers at the front to have. Hmm. You know, fast forward to like the 2000s, and what we realize is that almost all the antibiotics that we have in our arsenal, there's something out there that's resistant to them. So this is a problem that's become very acute for certain diseases. For example, tuberculosis is extremely drug resistant these days, and gonorrhea is extremely drug resistant these days. So mm-hmm. it's getting to the point where we have certain simple bacterial infections that we used to take for granted that we can no longer treat effectively. So this group, they sponsored a Tennessee-wide premiere of a film called The Silent Pandemic. It's made by a German director who is very passionate about this topic. It's the second film that he's made about this topic called, he's Michael Vec. And in this film, what he does is that he visits countries all around the world. He does the developed countries, he does developing countries, and he traces the kind of the problem. He wants everyone to see how the problem is different and yet the same in these different circumstances, right? It's everything from, like, in America, where you've got people overdosing on antibiotics casually, right? You're given antibiotics when you go get your wisdom tooth extracted. And there are at least two anecdotal cases who are interviewed, and one in this film and another in another film that I've watched, where as a result of these dental, like, procedures, they take the antibiotic and it knocks, like, everything in their gut out of whack. And they start to get these drug-resistant bacterial infections that are so serious that the two women that I recall, they only got better after taking an experimental stool transplant. Right, from a healthy family member to them, and that restores the balance of their gut community. Another really troubling case that I saw, a teenage girl in Germany who got a bacterial infection that took over 2 weeks to diagnose, and it was resistant to all the antibiotics that they gave her in the meantime. And by the time it was diagnosed, they had to amputate her hands and her legs.
Oh,
yeah. So her entire life down the drain because of this. And then we go to, you know, developing world where we find mass outbreaks of antibiotic resistant bacteria. This is one of the things I loved about the film is that they it's not the tragedies that anyone should be delighting in, but they're so important in highlighting the fact that we're facing this massive problem. And it's a lot of it's just self-inflicted. Like, it's because of the way we've misused antibiotics since it was discovered. And it's going to take us acting on multiple fronts to bring it under control, because one of the biggest users of antibiotics is the agricultural sector. And so even if we do everything we can to manage the problem in medical settings, the problem is that you've got maybe a feedlot that you're just throwing antibiotics into the feed to keep the cows happy and healthy. And ironically, somehow feeding antibiotics to your cows help them to accumulate muscle mass faster. So that gets them to the market faster. So it's very difficult to break farmers of this habit, because everybody wants to sell cheap meat, right? Mm. But yeah, that's one of the other films that I think we that really enjoyed from the last season of the Film Fest.
That first movie you were talking about, is there a modern equivalent to the child bed fever that they've since maybe discovered with science? Is it that you know of?
So childbed fever, thankfully, has come under control in most parts of the world, especially since we know that it's a bacterial infection. These days, they can actually give you antibiotics in case you develop it. But I think the major improvement has been that we've cleaned up indoors. You know, our hospitals are actually clean now. And
seemed like such a simple thing.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we forget, that you know, one of the inventions or discoveries that have made the most impact on our health, right, has been simply just antiseptics, disinfectants, right, washing your hands, right, eating better, right? So eating better, sleeping better, reducing workplace accidents. But it's like, it's about making, and the other big one I forgot, cleaning up our water, right? So that's been huge, because before that we had cholera, we had typhoid was rampant, right? Because a lot of the water that was coming out the pumps, a lot of our pipes or our taps, just wasn't safe to drink, right? And that's something that we take completely for granted these days. The other thing that I realized after watching a recent History Channel documentary about food and food history in America is that a lot of stuff that we used to eat just wasn't meant to be eaten, right? You know, and it's because people were poor, there was no refrigeration, and you used to do things like freeze things out in the winter in the ice. It's like, it's not cold enough. And it was, you know, the stuff that we think like, oh, this is something that you know, dishonest merchants might do. But the thing was that it was what everybody did in the past. You just took rotten food, you recycled, and you sold it again, right? You treated it somehow, you sold it again. And, you know, something like Heinz, right? When Heinz first came into the market, he insisted on selling his food in clear glass so you can actually see what you're getting. Whereas a lot of people sold with brown glass or green glass so that you couldn't tell.
You couldn't tell.
Yeah, you couldn't tell it was rotten.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
It is a wonder people lived past 20.
Really. It really is. So the life expectancies have gone all the way up. But, you know, it's just mind-boggling that you take that for granted in the world that we live in today, and people will challenge everything that that we've done or accomplished in public health.
It's funny to try to fight an enemy we can't see. It's something that we can't see, you can't touch, but it's there. You know, and so that's a hard thing. I think this is a great way to get students involved with these films, you know, that these things are deadly. It's not like you cut your hand and you you'll bleed.
Right.
It's not, it's very, you know, it's more mental, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's very true. I think the issue is that, you know, microorganisms are the bulk of life on the earth. I mean, all of our focus since we were kids are on people, and then the things that we think are closest to us, right? The big stuff that we can see that's fuzzy and cute, you know, like a panda or, you know, dolphins. And we forget that, you know, these microbes are everywhere on us, in us, regardless of whether we see them or not. And even though we don't want to be in a situation where we are paranoid or paralyzed, we've got to give them their credit, and we've got to pay attention to the ones that we know are dangerous, which are a very small minority, right? Hmm. As I was saying earlier, when we talked about antibiotics and how that can upset your gut. So one of the most fun, I think, screenings we had last season was the very last one, which was about the gut microbiota, all the microorganisms that live on you and in you, and how they keep you healthy. And if you overdo things and you try and like de-germ everything, that actually throws your system out of whack. It throws them out of whack. And then that creates opportunities for infectious diseases. It also, now we have evidence that that causes, you know, if you wipe out your healthy microbiota here, then interestingly, this is really cool, we're starting to see connections to neurological conditions like Alzheimer's and autism, right?
Wow.
So, no, it's not the vaccines. It's something it's something else, which may have something to do with the way we eat today. We're eating a lot of stuff that we didn't used to, a lot of the things like sugar replacements, right? So like artificial sweeteners, things like that, that can cause this kind of imbalance in the gut and create those opportunities for some of these conditions to occur. Yeah. So that's some of the really cool stuff that was coming out of this that I've students have caught up on, and I've caught up on as we've gone through the film festival.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would assume seems like it's going without saying here, but with the most recent pandemic, that's probably affected your research as much. What did you sort of find, I guess, if you continued research, similarities and differences between the two?
Okay. So I guess the thing about COVID-19, right, and I'm not a virologist, I should state that, right, my experience of microorganisms has been mostly with yeasts and with bacteria these days. But viruses, I can comment on as a kind of an outside observer. But I think one of the things that I'm really curious about with COVID-19 is whether or not, so one of the things that we need to answer is like, why are the coronaviruses coming up in this way? So COVID-19 is the third pandemic level coronavirus that affects humans to have come up in the last two decades. So SARS was the very first. MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus, was the second. And COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2, is the third. So one of the things that's unknown is why these coronaviruses are now coming up the way they have in a way they never have before. So why are they infecting us? And then there are a couple of other questions that come up. For example, why the original SARS kind of disappeared, right? MERS is around, but it thankfully hasn't adapted very well to humans. So it doesn't spread very easily human to human. So that's limited its impact. COVID-19 really took off. So one of the things we're trying to figure out is why. The people in the field are trying to figure out is why that's happened. The other things that we want to know is we want to try and understand the impact of long COVID now. And one of those things that we are learning is that the immune system, which was so key to the 1918 flu. So earlier when I said that the 20 to 40 year olds were dying in the second wave of 1918, that was a lot because their immune systems were reacting to something it had never encountered before and was overreacting, if you will. So your immune system is trying to fight off this new virus, but it doesn't know how. And in the process, when I describe the immune system to my students, I always tell them, don't think of the immune system as your friend. It's really more an ally, right? And it's an ally that's essentially like a watchdog. And watchdogs can either be trained to attack specific targets, or they will just go crazy and attack everything that they don't recognize, right? So the issue in 1918 was that I think the immune system of the young people was attacking everything because they couldn't figure out what was troubling them. So the immune system was just going crazy, trying to attack everything, and in the process causing so much damage to the host that the host dies. I think with long COVID, what we're seeing is that, and I've talked to a couple people about this, I think the opinion really is that a lot of the long COVID symptoms are because the immune system overreacted to something that's new. And so the persistent effects, like, for example, a lot of people have complained about, this kind of brain fog after they recover. Mm-hmm. That could be because the immune system caused that damage. It's not the virus itself, but the virus has tricked your immune system into reacting, overreacting, causing that damage. I think some of the direct virus infects that we've seen, for example, the loss of taste and smell, that's been attributed to the virus itself. But a lot of stuff, the fatigue, the brain fog, the pains that don't seem to go away, the cardiac arrhythmias, those seem to be because of the immune system. Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, there could be other things that we don't realize yet. So, for example, when I started looking at the 1918 flu, one of the things that we realized from more recent studies of the flu virus is that the flu virus travels way beyond the respiratory system. So they found that the flu virus can actually get past the blood-brain barrier to the brain as well. And it can get to the heart. It can attack the gut. And we've seen that with the coronaviruses as well. They can actually get to the gastroenteric tract. There's some evidence they get to the heart. I don't know if they can get to the brain yet. But the other thing that we got to remember is that, when you have a brand new disease, a brand new pathogen, it's not very smart to say, nah, it's going to be fine. Right? The thing is, we don't know enough, right? And even some of our oldest enemies, like tuberculosis bacterium, it's been around so long that it's figured us out a lot better than we figured it out, right? I think there's one quote from Contagion where there's a staff member, a researcher at the CDC who's expressing a lot of frustration with the virus, and Ellis Cheever, he's the fictional CDC director, Lawrence Fishburne's character, and he's saying in the film, he says, well, the virus doesn't have anything else to do, right? we have our lives to lead,
right.
But the virus is just,
just there.
It's just there. Yeah. It's figuring itself out. And I think, and that's tuberculosis is going to be topic for the March event in this year's film festival. So in March, we'll have a film to look at the forgotten plague, which is tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit about that, when you have a bacterium that's been co-evolving with us, making us sick for 3,000 to 5,000 years, that's a long time for it to figure out how to defeat everything that we have in our body that could take this bacterium down. It's come up with a defense against literally everything we can throw at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
We had here in Davidson County, we had the tuberculosis hospital, it was separate. And then before that, it was called the pest house. We didn't know what was wrong with you, so we're going to put you over there. And we've actually had some volunteers in the past that were at that old hospital, and they felt that one of the treatment methods was to sit outside. Mm-hmm. And so he would sit out on the porch in freezing weather, and he felt like the dense air was better for you,
Yep.
And so we've come such a long way, but it's still there, and it's still, we've defeated it in times past, but it's funny how these things burn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they adapt really fast. The antibiotic streptomycin, it was the second antibiotic to be discovered. I think that was in 1943-44. Mm-hmm. And then they threw it at TB patients, and some of them got better, but by the year's end, some of them had TB again, and the TB was streptomycin resistant. Hmm. And, the with TB today, right, it's the level of drug resistance we're seeing is so bad that when somebody comes in, they immediately assume that you have multiple drug resistant TB, and they're going to start you on a course of maybe 4 different antibiotics from the get-go.
Wow.
Yeah, because they're going to try and tame this before it gets out of control. But there are some extremely drug-resistant strains which are resistant to more than 6 different antibiotics, right? And the funny thing is that the only new antibiotics coming down the line now in the last 2 decades, there are 3, and all 3 were developed to treat TB, specifically TB.
Wow.
And it's no longer, the age that we live in, we used to pull antibiotics out of soil, right? And penicillin used to cost maybe cents for a dose. In today's world, the new antibiotics, they cost the same as chemotherapeutic drugs, right? And for some people, TB is such a prevalent disease in poor parts of the world. for some of those people, literally getting it might be a death sentence because you can't afford the new drugs.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, jeez. Mm-hmm. That's so sad. Mm-hmm. Mm, goodness. Well, as far as the film festival, right now, it's open to your students, but is it open to the public at all?
Yeah, it's actually open and free to the public to attend. Perfect. The other thing that we do is that we stream online via Zoom.
Oh.
That's been really powerful. I think one of the few good things that came out of the COVID-19 pandemic was that we figured out how to do things better online. Mm. And that's really allowed me to pull people from experts from around the country as well as from abroad. And also it allows people to join us who are not in Pulaski, not in Tennessee. Yeah, because... Okay. You know, driving down to Pulaski is going to be quite a stretch for most people. So
sure.
I think that's been a huge boon. But yeah, we've been trying to advertise. I've had very limited success, but I've advertised through the local library system around Giles County. I've also tried advertising through the newspaper and the radio station locally. But so far, really, it's been more word of mouth and social media that draws people in who are not on the campus.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could get your link.
Maybe
sure.
Do something
definitely.
With that.
Yeah.
Advertise it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Especially with the podcast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Love to. And yeah, I think that'll be great. I mean, the more people we can reach, I think the better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure I could think of about 1,000 other questions, but for the sake of time, is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Anything you want to mention?
I don't know. I think I'll probably just end with, you know, a kind of vignette about military history and infectious diseases. And I think it's an important thing to remember. This is pointed out by my historian colleague, that in most conflicts, you know, that we've looked at prior to World War II, I think, just remember that, you know, the majority of the casualties were never on the battlefield. Mm. I think even for World War One, right, the majority of American casualties, they died of not very glamorous things. It was either you got an accident or more likely than not, you died because of disease. Mm-hmm. And there's a very callous term that gets associated with this. I think my colleague says it dates back to the Crimean War. I think the British Army used to write off casualties from sickness as waste.
Oh,
yeah. And truly it is. I mean, Florence Nightingale, I think one of her most important contributions was to convince people that this waste was unnecessary.
Mm.
Right? That it's all about cleaning up and, you know. Yeah. But anyway.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Something you remember about the next time you watch a war film.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it.
There's a lot more to it.
Yeah.
More to it.
Sure,
a lot more is taking place behind the lines.
Yeah.
Well, I think there'll definitely be a sequel to this if we can get you back up here.
Yeah, for sure. This is great.
Thank you. Thank you all.
We appreciate your time, Dr. Chi. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Mm-hmm.